The Defenestration of Ermentrude Inch, first published in Tales from the White Hart.
An unusual story from the White Hart, in which Harry Purvis seemingly meets his match when his wife discovers the location of his quantum mechanics lectures. It also chronicles the move from the White Hart to the Sphere, matching the move from the White Horse to the Globe, following the landlord, Lou Mordecai.
And now I have a short, sad duty to perform. One of the many mysteries about Harry Purvis, who was so informative in every other direction, was the existence or otherwise of a Mrs. Purvis. It was true that he wore no wedding ring, but that means little nowadays. Almost as little as an hotel proprietor will tell you, as does the reverse. In a number of his tales, Harry had shown distinct evidence of some hostility towards what a Polish friend of mine, whose command of English did not match his gallantry, always referred to as ladies of the female sex. And it was by a curious coincidence that the very last story he ever told us first indicated and then proved conclusively Harry's marital status. I do not know who brought up the word defenestration, which is not, after all, one of the most commonly used abstractions in the language. It was probably one of the alarmingly erudite younger members of the White Hart clientele. Some of them are just out of college, and so make us old-timers feel very callow and ignorant. But from the word, the discussion naturally passed to the deed. Had any of us ever been defenestrated? Did we know anyone who had? "Yes," said Harry. "It happened to a verbose lady I once knew. She was called Ermentrude, and was married to Osbert Inch, a sound engineer at the BBC. Osbert spent all his working hours listening to other people talking, and most of his free time listening to Ermentrude. Unfortunately, he couldn't switch her off at the turn of a knob, and so he very seldom had a chance of getting a word in edgeways." There are some women who appear sincerely unaware of the fact that they cannot stop talking, and are most surprised when anyone accuses them of monopolizing the conversation. Ermentrude would start as soon as she woke up, change gear so that she could hear herself speak above the 8 o'clock news, and continue unabated until Osbert thankfully left for work. A couple of years of this had almost reduced him to a nervous wreck. But one morning, when his wife was handicapped by a long overdue attack of laryngitis, he made a spirited protest against her vocal monopoly. To his incredulous disbelief, she flatly refused to accept the charge. It appeared that to Ermentrude, time ceased to exist when she was talking, but she became extremely restive when anyone else held the stage. As soon as she had recovered her voice, she told Osbert how unfair it was of him to make such an unfounded accusation, and the argument would have been very acrimonious if it had been possible to have an argument with Ermentrude at all. This made Osbert an angry and also a desperate man. But he was an ingenious one, too, and it occurred to him that he could produce irrefutable evidence that Ermentrude talked 100 words for every syllable he was able to utter. I mentioned that he was a sound engineer, and his room was fitted up with hi-fi set, tape recorder, and the usual electronic tools of his trade, some of which the BBC had unwittingly supplied. It did not take him very long to construct a piece of equipment which one might call a selective word counter. If you know anything about audio engineering, you'll appreciate how it could be done with suitable filters and dividing circuits. And if you don't, you'll have to take it for granted. What the apparatus did was simply this. A microphone picked up every word spoken in the Inch apartment. Osbert's deeper tones went one way and registered on a counter marked his, and Ermentrude's higher frequencies went the other direction and ended up on the counter marked hers. Within an hour of switching on, the score was as follows. His, 23, hers, 2,530. As the numbers flicked across the counter dials, Ermentrude became more and more thoughtful, and at the same time more and more silent. Osbert, on the other hand, drinking the heady wine of victory, though to anyone else it would have looked like his morning cup of tea, began to make the most of his advantage and became quite talkative. By the time he had left for work, the Countess had reflected the changing status in the household. His, 1,043, hers, 3,397. Just to show who was now the boss, Osbert left the apparatus switched on. He had always wondered if Ermyntrude talked to herself as a purely automatic reflex, even when there was no one around to hear what she was saying. He had, by the way, thoughtfully taken the precaution of putting a lock on the counter so that his wife couldn't turn it off while he was out. He was a little disappointed to find that the figures were quite unaltered when he came home that evening, but thereafter the score soon started to mount again. It became a kind of game, though a deadly serious one, with each of the protagonists keeping one eye on the machine whenever either of them said a word. Ermyntrude was clearly discomforted. Ever and again she would suffer a verbal relapse and increase her score by a couple of hundred before she brought herself to a halt by a supreme effort of self-control. Osbert, who still had such a lead that he could afford to be garrulous, amused himself by making occasional sardonic comments, which were well worth the expenditure of a few score points. Although a measure of equality had been restored in the Inch household, the word counter had, if anything, increased the state of dissension. Presently, Ermyntrude, who had a certain natural intelligence which some people might have called craftiness, made an appeal to her husband's better nature. She pointed out that neither of them was really behaving naturally while every word was being monitored and counted. Osbert had unfairly let her get ahead, and was now being taciturn in a way that he would never have been had he not got the warning score continuously before his eyes. Though Osbert gagged at the sheer effrontery of this charge, he had to admit that the objection did contain an element of truth. The test would be fairer and more conclusive if neither of them could see the accumulating score. If, indeed, they forgot all about the presence of the machine and so behaved perfectly naturally, or at least as naturally as they could in the circumstances. After much argument, they came to a compromise. Very sportingly, in his opinion, Osbert reset the dials to zero and sealed up the counter window so that no one could take a peek at the scores. They agreed to break the wax seals, on which they had both impressed their fingerprints, at the end of the week, and to abide by the decision. Concealing the microphone under a table, Osbert moved the counter equipment itself into his little workshop, so that the living room now bore no sign of the implacable electronic watchdog that was controlling the destiny of the Inches. Thereafter, things slowly returned to normal. Ermyntrude became as talkative as ever. But now Osbert didn't mind in the least, because he knew that every word she uttered was being patiently noted to be used as evidence against her. At the end of the week, his triumph would be complete. He could afford to allow himself the luxury of a couple of hundred words a day, knowing that Ermyntrude used up this allowance in 5 minutes. The breaking of the seals was performed ceremonially at the end of an unusually talkative day, when Ermyntrude had repeated verbatim 3 telephone conversations of excruciating banality, which it seemed had occupied most of her afternoon. Osbert had merely smiled and said, "Yes, dear," at 10-minute intervals, meanwhile trying to imagine what excuse his wife would put forward when confronted by the damning evidence. Imagine, therefore, his feelings when the seals were removed to disclose the week's total. His 143,567, hers 32,590. Osbert stared at the incredible figures with stunned disbelief. Something had gone wrong, but where? There must, he decided, have been a fault in the apparatus. It was annoying, very annoying, for he knew perfectly well that Ermyntrude would never let him live it down, even if he proved conclusively that the counter had gone haywire. Ermyntrude was still crowing victoriously when Osbert pushed her out of the room and started to dismantle his errant equipment. He was halfway through the job when he noticed something in his waste paper basket, which he was sure he hadn't put there. It was a closed loop of tape a couple of feet long, and he was quite unable to account for its presence, as he had not used the tape recorder for several days. He picked it up, and as he did so, suspicion exploded into certainty. He glanced at the recorder. The switches, he was quite sure, were not as he had left them. Ermyntrude was crafty, but she was also careless. Osbert had often complained that she never did a job properly, and here was the final proof. His den was littered with old tapes carrying unerased test passages he had recorded. It had been no trouble at all for Ermyntrude to locate one, snip off a few words, stick the ends together, switch to playback, and leave the machine running hour after hour in front of the microphone. Osbert was furious with himself for not having thought of so simple a ruse. If the tape had been strong enough, he would probably have strangled Ermyntrude with it. Whether he tried to do anything of the sort is still uncertain. All we know is that she went out of the apartment window, and of course it could have been an accident, but there was no way of asking her, as the Inches lived four stories up. I know that defenestration is usually deliberate, and the coroner had some pointed words to say on the subject, but nobody could prove that Osbert pushed her, and the whole thing soon blew over. About a year later, he married a charming little deaf and dumb girl, and they're one of the happiest couples I know. There was a long pause when Harry had finished. Whether out of disbelief or out of respect for the late Mrs. Inch, it would be hard to say. But before anyone could make a suitable comment, the door was thrown open, and a formidable blonde advanced into the private bar of the White Hart. It is seldom indeed that life arranges its climaxes as neatly as this. Harry Purvis turned very pale and tried in vain to hide himself in the crowd. He was instantly spotted and pinned down beneath a barrage of invective. "So this," we heard with interest, "is where you've been giving your Wednesday evening lectures on quantum mechanics? I should have checked up with the university years ago. Harry Purvis, you're a liar, and I don't mind if everybody knows it. And as for your friends," she gave us all a scathing look, "it's a long time since I've seen such a scruffy lot of tipplers." "Hey, just a minute," protested Drew from the other side of the counter. She quelled him with a glance, then turned upon poor Harry again. "Come along," she said. "You're going home. No, you needn't finish that drink. I'm sure you've already had more than enough." Obediently, Harry Purvis picked up his briefcase and coat. "Very well, Ermyntrude," he said meekly. I will not bore you with the long and still unsettled arguments as to whether Mrs. Purvis really was called Ermyntrude, or whether Harry was so dazed that he automatically applied the name to her. We all have our theories about that, as indeed we have about everything concerning Harry. All that matters now is the sad and indisputable fact that no one has ever seen him since that evening. It is just possible that he doesn't know where we meet nowadays, for a few months later the White Hart was taken over by a new management, and we all followed Drew, lock, stock and barrel, particularly Barrel, to his new establishment. Our weekly sessions now take place at the Sphere, and for a long time many of us used to look up hopefully when the door opened to see if Harry had managed to escape and find his way back to us. It is indeed partly in the hope that he will see this book and hence discover our new location that I have gathered these tales together. Even those who never believed a word you spoke miss you, Harry. If you have to defenestrate Ermyntrude to regain your freedom, do it on a Wednesday evening between 6 and 11, and there'll be 40 people in the Sphere who'll provide you with an alibi. But get back somehow. Things have never been quite the same since you went."